During the day, the high is in the low 80s. Rain again for Sunday night, and the lows will be in the mid-60s. In sports, the Yankees are in Milwaukee against the Brewers for a night game. Colorado plays the Cubs at Wrigley this afternoon, and the White Sox are in Detroit for a night game. Finally, in college football, the Wisconsin Badgers play New Mexico State in Madison tomorrow at 2:30 p.m., and on Sunday, the Bears play the Packers at Lambeau at 7:20 p.m. You're listening to WGTD News, where we have news in the morning four times an hour.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's easy to jump to the conclusion that racism has never been more serious, severe, or pervasive, or that incidents of hate crimes against blacks and other minorities have never been more numerous than they are today. But as actor Will Smith famously remarked back in 2016, racism isn't getting worse. Racism is getting filmed. He was referring to the fact that so many of us walk around with cell phones in our pocket that have high-quality cameras. And with those cameras, we can capture not only cute images of our pets and children or of what we had for breakfast at the neighborhood cafe, but we can also capture important and disturbing images, such as the killing of George Floyd by Derek Chauvin in May of 2020. Captured in video footage by a courageous young woman on the scene named Darnella Frazier. And she was able not only to capture those images, but then to share them with the wider world. How this changes our cultural landscape is explored in a new book called The Prophetic Lens, The Camera, and Black Moral Agency from Martin Luther King to Darnella Frazier. The author, Phil Allen, is a PhD candidate in Christian ethics at Fuller Theological Seminary. His previous book is titled Open Wounds, A Story of Racial Tragedy, Trauma, and Redemption. His latest book, The Prophetic Lens, is published by Fortress Press. And before we get into the book, I want to give you just a moment to talk about something that's mentioned in your biography. It is something that you founded and serve as executive director. What is the Racial Solidarity Project?
Yeah, thank you. Racial Solidarity Project, or RSP, as I call it, is a nonprofit I founded a couple of years ago. I wanted to have a space of my own where I would engage issues of race, that intersection of race and theology. So our focus is four pillars of activism. So we start with justice and equity advocacy. And that's where we try to partner with organizations that are doing the work rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and trying to do everything ourselves. So like right now, we have a fundraiser coming up next weekend, and we have a 5K run walk. We're also raising funds not just for our organization, but for Green Line Housing Foundation, where they try to close the racial wealth gap through home ownership. So we'll partner with the Rodney King Foundation and scholarship young black fathers who that don't have the means or the resources to take their kids to, say, Disneyland or Universal Studios or something like that. So we'll partner with organizations like that. Education is another pillar of activism. That's where we have these small cohorts. We did one earlier this year. I think it went really well, where we bring in people, different backgrounds, and we have the hard, serious conversation around race, racism, and having the tough conversation that we normally don't have publicly or in other spaces. And we do it in a small space so that people can feel safe, get to know one another, and engage over a series of meetings. The third pillar of activism is wellness. There's a reason why we can't really have the conversation. And as people of color, particularly as African Americans, we hold intergenerational trauma. We hold the trauma from our own personal experiences. We hold the trauma from our parents and grandparents' generation, our history. So we can be easily triggered. Whether we have a resiliency and we can hold it together or not, we're still triggered, and we have to carry that from comments that are made. Sometimes our stories are dismissed, things like that. But then also, when we talk about the white community, we hear the term white fragility. And there's also a type of trauma that may be held there as well. And we are engaged in this conversation, and we're not always well, so it doesn't go well. And so we try to include practices of wellness and help people, and this is built into our workshops, our cohort, help people develop the skills to self-regulate in the moment so that they can engage the conversation and engage the work of anti-racism. And not to mention, just doing the work itself can be draining. Like writing this book and my previous book, it takes a toll to deal with the data and the history and my own history. So I have to have rhythms of wellness to even endure this. And then lastly, community building. It's more than just about getting justice. It's about forming a new kind of community. And this is where Dr. King's beloved community concept comes into play. There has to be a vision, not just to get justice for an event, but to change, to cause change, that we have a different consciousness among us, a different vision for our community. Hmm. So those are the four pillars of activism for RSP, and we're just getting started, and hopefully we'll be doing this for a long time.
Very good. Sounds very, very promising and important. Ahead of us talking real specifically about the book, I want to talk more generally about the place of your own Christian faith in your activism. I mean, and to the point that the title of your book is The Prophetic Lens, and you spend a little bit of time in your book talking about prophetic ministry and of how the camera, for instance, that Dinella Frazier was, in a sense, wielding at the event of George Floyd's murder, that this was a case of that camera being used prophetically as a prophetic tool. So clearly you are comfortable with much of the terminology and the framework that your own faith has given you. I'm just curious in a more general sense about the significance of that faith, the way in which it guides the way you view some of these issues, your work as an activist. And do you find that there is ever a challenge in terms of how much to make that a part of, for instance, your own rhetoric, the imagery that you use or whatever, since, of course, you are sharing insights that you want to resonate with all kinds of different people, including people who are not part of your own faith tradition?
A great question. My faith is foundational to pretty much everything I do. Like I consider my faith when I make decisions, when I'm writing this book. So my faith is foundational to the work that I do. But it is a challenge, because I don't want to exclude. I want to have the language in the conversation with people even outside of faith or religion at all. I think the word prophetic, though we use it in the Christian faith, I hear it oftentimes outside of the church. I hear it in secular spaces. I hear it in music. I hear it in films where people use the term prophetic or talk to someone as a prophet. So when I think about my faith, that's why I'm not afraid to use that language. And it gives me an opportunity to pull people in and begin to think about this topic of race or racism through a theological lens, whether they agree or disagree, but at least consider the lens to see through. But there is tension there, because there was a time when I didn't have the language to even engage this conversation in this way, although I knew this was, it should be. I mean, you can go back to the civil rights movement. It was grounded in the faith, in the Christian faith. The black church was significant, played a powerful, significant role in liberative efforts, I'll say, from sustaining the enslaved to fighting back against lynching. So our faith has always been a part of, for the most part, of our activism. But there was a time I didn't have the language. There was a time I was a little frustrated and confused because I was in conservative, predominantly white Christian spaces for a number of years as a pastor. And no one was talking about this. No one addressed social issues, really, other than maybe homosexuality or abortion. But other than that, everything was personal, individual salvation and discipleship and what have you. But I knew that wasn't the case, that it shouldn't be that way. And so part of me hopes that the church, that part of the church is an audience for this book as well, to pull them into and not separate social issues and things seemingly beyond the church from the church as if they're in with this binary framework, but to integrate and to see how our faith should be a part of activism. Like the prophets in the very Bible that we read. my faith is pretty important, but I don't think we have to have the language that excludes people. And I can speak the language, and I can just use the principles and speak a very different language that includes more people in the conversation.
Hmm. We're speaking with Phil Allen Jr., talking about his newest book, The Prophetic Lens, The Camera, and Black Moral Agency. I don't remember you saying it in so many words, but I am assuming that the aforementioned event in May of 2020 is what really galvanized you to consider this topic and to write this book, the event in May 20 in which George Floyd was killed by police officer Derek Chauvin, and that scene was caught on video by Darnella Frazier, which of course helped completely reshape what had been the narrative of what actually happened to Mr. Floyd. Was that really the kind of the seminal inspiration for this book, or even ahead of that, had you already considered the power of the camera when it comes to capturing events like that?
Yeah, so the George Floyd murder did not really play a role in writing this book. It was before and after that. So 2 years before that, or a year and a half before that, I went to Sundance Film Festival and for a class, for a directed study with a professor. And so I'm watching film, and my idea was to write about how Dr. King used the camera in this prophetic way as a tool, as a resource during the civil rights movement. And it was actually a critical resource. If it weren't for the camera there, where would we be? And so I went to Sundance, and I saw so many films, and I was a part of an organization called Windrider, and they're a Christian organization, but they curate a space of conversation around the films and with the directors, sometimes the star actors, the producers, the writers, and not all Christian audience, but of Christian filmmakers, but most of them are from Christian organizations, Christian schools. And they talked about the prophetic ministry or the prophetic way that these films or impact these films have. And I kept hearing prophetic. And I walked away and I wrote a paper called The Prophetic Lens. So this started off in 2019 as a paper, and I repurposed it a couple of times and published in a couple of journals, a journal and an anthology. But then it was fast forwarding to Derek Chauvin's trial, and that was the catalyst. So I had this paper sitting here, and after the trial, and I realized the camera was the star witness, the video footage, I'm sorry, was the star witness. And this camera is an extension of Darnella Frazier's work. The camera itself is not prophetic, but it's an extension of someone who, whether consciously or not, is engaged in prophetic, the disrupting work, disrupting the dominant narrative. See, this is what's actually happening here. So the camera was critical to that in that trial, and that's when I decided to write the book.
Hmm. It's in chapter 4 of the book, Uncovered Truth, a Prophetic Alternative, that you kind of explore this whole notion of being a prophet, of what prophetic work is, and of indeed of how prophets come to disrupt, to upturn previously understood understandings about how the world is and how we are to live within it. In talking about this, you quote an author by the name of Walter Brueggemann, and some of our listeners may know of his work, and you specifically quote a book of his called Prophetic Imagination, which outlines a couple of important ways, really two factors in particular, that must be a part of the work of a prophet in order for them to be effective. Explain to our listeners these two elements of prophetic ministry and how they both must be present.
Yes. So Brueggemann talks about the prophetic ministry as the activity that nurtures, nourishes, and evokes an alternative consciousness. To me, that's the key part of it, evoking an alternative consciousness. And then he talks about criticizing, two elements that must be there, criticizing and energizing. So there's a criticizing of the status quo, the dominant consciousness, those in power. We've heard the phrase speaking truth to power. That's the criticizing part. And I think capturing scenes like what we saw with George Floyd, and in the case with Arbery, it's more of the publishing, the leaking and publishing of the video, because the person who shot the video was not doing it trying to help George Floyd. But that in of itself is inherently critical of policing, of anti-black violence, whether they mean for it to be or not. The fact that you capture that event and you publish it for the world to see is a type of criticizing act, on top of rhetoric and, again, speaking truth to power, and the protests where people are speaking out about injustices and inequities. But then there's also the energizing part. And energizing, as I'm thinking about it, it could be a good thing, and it could also fall short. Brueggemann talks about energizing an alternative community with that alternative consciousness. Usually it's communities from the margins, those who have perceived less power. And so because you can't just do something and then go back to everything is normal. There has to be this energizing for something new. But that energy could be something new, a fight for justice, a revolution for justice, and that's it. My opinion, the energizing has to be about justice, equity, but also the energy, sustained energy to form a new community, a new humanity, I heard someone say once.
Hmm. Going beyond the anger that one might feel to a vision for how the world should be and how we should be living.
Yeah. And the anger is understandable. I mean, who wasn't angry? And for African Americans, who hasn't been angry? My story, sometimes I can tell a whole story about my life engaging racism. But at some point, if we as a collective do not heal and move forward and there be allies and a multi-ethnic, multicultural movement towards a newness, then we'll be having the same conversation 20, 30, 50 years from now every time something happens, because we haven't moved to the new. So that has to be a part of it. The energizing has to include energizing an alternative consciousness, an alternative community that tries to form something new. And it's very idealistic, but the pursuit of it, that's the work that we have to engage in as well.
I wanted to ask you about another term that you used in talking about the killing of George Floyd. And I'm trying to find it, but I'm not seeing it at the moment. But someplace in the book, as you talk about that being an incredibly important moment in the history of race relations in our country, you call it an event that was catalytic, as in the catalytic converter that one has in one's car. And I guess I'm not enough of a car mechanic to understand that term. And I just found it. Some have commented that George Floyd changed the world. He did not ask to die with a knee on his neck. I believe what happened to Floyd was a tragic but catalytic event that caused some change in the world. This speaks to what we were talking about before. Explain a little further what you mean by those words.
Yes. So we remember, I think you alluded to the statement that the Minneapolis Police Department put out initially that really does not reflect what we saw in that video. One could say it was a flat-out lie, argue it was a lie. And it was basically saying there's no there. And people say George Floyd changed the world, and so you can argue that, but I think it was Darnella Frazier who changed the world, because she was the one who had the presence of mind to record, not just to yell for the police to stop, but she pulled her camera out and she recorded, and she stood there with resiliency and enough composure to capture this man dying in front of her. She saw a man lose his life in front of her. That's traumatic. But it was the publishing of that video that changed the narrative and was world-changing, because it started this global movement. If she did not record, we might have the surveillance, some body cam footage, but I don't think it would have been as strong as the video that she took. But the event itself was catalytic. George Floyd did not ask for it. He did not seek it. He did not want it. If he were alive today, I guarantee you he would say, I wouldn't want to go through that again. But it was the event that was catalytic, that started, it happened. And from that point on, the release of the video, the evidence shown, that's what actually changed the world. Much like Emmett Till didn't ask to be killed, but his picture published in the Jet magazine, that's what was catalytic for the civil rights movement. That's what was part of what made Rosa Parks sit. She was tired and she was motivated after that. Many historians will say that was the event that led to the momentum for the civil rights movement. And I think the George Floyd event was similar once it was published. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Rosa Parks, reminds me of when you talk in your book about the most noteworthy years of the civil rights movement and some of the most important events, and how certain events, of course, were captured in news footage that changed everything in terms of people maybe being shaken from their complacency or maybe coming to a new clarity about what was going on in the Deep South, in some of these areas. Our listeners know exactly what I'm talking about. But we are talking, of course, about footage and images being captured by the news media versus regular people. And I suppose that whole matter of, thank goodness for what we were able to see, but one wonders how would the world have changed if ordinary people could have captured what was happening in their lives, happening to their loved ones, happening to their neighbors, if that had been possible at that point in time, versus so much of that violence against blacks occurring in a sense in private, behind closed doors, or out of the public eye. Do you think very much about what that would have meant if such a thing would have been possible then?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the civil rights movement, the leaders of the movement had to rely on the goodwill of the news reporters, or the cameramen there, that they would have wanted to capture this violence and publish it and broadcast it. I wish, you know, I think about, we talk about lynching often, and we have a certain number, but it doesn't begin to capture the amount of people who were lynched, particularly in the South. My grandfather was lynched. He was not hung from a tree, but in the social connotation of the word, he was lynched. A mob of three men that he knew set him up, and his employer, his boss, shot him in the back of the head as he tried to get away. Well, there's no video footage, even though there was supposedly a witness that saw the struggle right before it happened. She never came forth. There was never any investigation. And whenever I screen my film, my documentary film, Open Wounds, there's always someone, especially of the older generation, through tears, will recall and share a story of a family member where it happened similarly to them. My great-grandfather was lynched. Again, not hung from a tree, but he was killed at the hands of racism. Wasn't captured on film, and it's not counted in the data. And so, yes, if we had cameras back then, if we had this technology, if the camera was democratized back then, I think we would have caught way more. We would have seen way more evidence of the violence that was occurring during that time. But fortunately, those cameramen, I call them in the book allies. They were allies of the movement, and their lives were on the line. Their lives were in jeopardy for simply coming in the South, broadcasting, recording, documenting, and publishing what was happening. So I wish we did have more access back then. I think lives might have been saved. Progress might have been made much quicker.
You remind us about one of the most painful moments from that era, and that was the brutal murder of Emmett Till. And you remind us of a decision that his grieving mother made for the casket to be open and for people to see the body of her son, because she wanted people to see what had been done to young Emmett. And of course, that was a certain kind of visual representation, sadly, after the fact. But even that had a tremendous impact, and probably points to something that we sometimes take for granted, but which is the power of a visual image that takes us beyond mere words.
Yeah, that was brave. That was courageous. And it also had to be painful for her to make that decision to want the world to see. When I was a kid and I would see that image when I was really young, I didn't think it was real. I didn't think a person could look like that. But it showed the extent of the violence and depravity of life, the lack of care for life that he had to endure and black folks had to endure during that time. But we respond to visual imagery. This even still shots like that. I call it in the book, I mentioned nonverbal language of images that we can. It forces us, imagery forces us to have to reflect, to pause, to gaze, to internalize, whether for good reasons or bad reasons, we end up internalizing it, especially if we see it enough of those images. And then it becomes an embodied experience, or we have an embodied response. Like, for instance, you asked me about I've been asked about my response to the George Floyd video. Well, the image itself, whether it was a video or if it was a still shot, it was triggering for me because of my past and my history with law enforcement. So that image, more than just words, more than just causing us to imagine what may have happened, the still shots tell us this is what actually happened, and we have to now confront it, or it confronts us. Or in the book, I say it invites us also to look at truth, to look at reality. I think the video images go further than the still shots, though. They give us breath. They give us the extent, the longevity of the incident. They give us sound as well. So all those things give us a chance to have an embodied experience with what's happening. Mm. And then we respond to that. I think it's human nature to respond to that.
Your book goes on further to describe another aspect of the video footage captured by Darnell Frazier, which I think some people might not fully appreciate. I know that I did not until I read this passage in your book. You tell us that one of the most important things we experience when we watch that footage, and especially when we watch it carefully, and when we watch, in particular, Officer Chauvin, we see him looking right into Darnella Frazier's camera, unafraid. I mean, in a sense, untroubled that somebody is filming this. And you tell us that that really says something powerful about the position or perspective from which he was operating in that moment.
Yes. So one critical part of the video, Darnella Frazier, is proximity to the event. It's one thing if she was standing across the street and was recording the video, but she was right there, maybe 10 feet away, 8 feet away from what was happening. And that, from that vantage point, is where we could see, unlike maybe a little bit of body cam footage, but not in the same way, unlike the surveillance across cameras across the street, we could see his eyes, his expression, his body language. We could see how relaxed he was. We could hear George Floyd's cries, his mom saying he can't breathe, all of that. And I think that's part of the idea of prophetic, in is location and proximity to pain, trauma, the willingness to be there, to be present there. And I think that was, she should be commended for that, that she remained present. She didn't turn away. She didn't turn the camera off. She didn't try to mind her own business. She remained present. That should be a lesson for all of us. And I'm not saying, you know, sometimes we see people get too involved in what law enforcement's doing. I think there's a responsibility if you're going to have a camera, because you can also make it unsafe for everybody there. But to follow her lead and remain as composed as possible, without walking away, but also without getting too close and making matters worse. So I think to answer the question in short, location, proximity to the pain, proximity to the event, the tragedy, is important. It was a perspective that no other video evidence provided us.
Mm. There's something else that you mention a little later in the book that I think is important. This comes in Chapter 7, which is titled When the Bystander Aims and Shoots. And this is where you talk about how Darnell Frazier needed to be feeling a number of things, including courage to and having presence of mind to stand there as close as she could and capture what she was capturing. It was so important to do that. You write, just as the cameramen from national news networks were allies of King in the civil rights movement, the engaged bystander can be the ally for the victim and the victim's family in the event the victim does not survive the violence perpetrated against them. Prophetic ministry begins with presence. Prophetic work requires the presence of those from the margins who have the instincts and courage to act as disruptors of the activities of power. But it begins not just with presence, but with love. More than just physical presence, both require consciousness, seeing, and hearing others. That is, Donella Fraser had to have a profound sense of concern and a profound appreciation for the injustice of what was being done to George Floyd in that moment. And that had to help carry her. And I appreciate you saying that, because I think, on the other hand, you know, a lot of us who walk around with cameras on our phones, we are eager to use that when there's some traffic accident, or there's some wildfire, or there's some other kind of dramatic, wild thing going on. And it's not necessarily that we capture those images with a sense of sincere concern, but more like, wow, this is something. I'm going to post this. And man, it's more like capturing something because of the excitement of it, versus what we're talking about with Darnella Fraser. She was not capturing those images because there was anything exciting about it, but because it was profoundly disturbing to her. And she wanted in that moment to make some kind of a difference for the better. And that's probably a really important thing for all of us to remember in all of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The prophetic ministry, authentic prophetic ministry, is selfless. We can get caught up in the passion, the fire, and oftentimes, some depending on who it is, they may be loud, but authentic prophetic ministry is selfless, because it is concern for neighbor or neighbors, the individual or the collective, and that love, that concern. You use the word concern. I like that as appropriate. Has to be there. A concern for where society is. A concern for the happenings in society around them, even if it doesn't touch their lives directly. Like, they're not the ones, the victim of it. There has to be a love there. We talk about loving our neighbor. Well, you can't love your neighbor if you see your neighbor being harmed and you keep moving. The prophet is not only going to call it out, the harm that's done, but the prophet is going to be present because of the neighbor. And we forget that part of the prophetic ministry, the love aspect of it, the concern aspect of it. And I think, again, that can be a model for how we ought to be, and what we can use it specifically dealing with race or racism, and we can take this and use it for any other social issue. But there has to be some type of deep sense of love and concern for one's neighbor to operate in that prophetic ministry.
You move beyond what we have primarily been talking about to also talk about important black filmmakers who have, you think, made a significant difference with many of their works. I want to give you just a moment to highlight maybe one or two that you want to underscore for our listeners and maybe have them investigate further.
Well, I think, and I recently, before writing this book, someone told me, a filmmaker told me about Oscar Michelle. And he was the forerunner, if you will, for black filmmakers. And what he did, coming off of the, behind Birth of a Nation, that this racist film that really reified this narrative about the dangerous black man, especially if I was a target get really narrow and focused on its target, the dangerous black man, but also it depicted black women in a negative light as well. And its narrative has its legacy even today, not just in filmmaking, but just in society, that I'm a danger, particularly to white women. And there's an assumed guilt, assumed criminalization, assumed threat there. Well, Oscar Micheaux comes in, and he wants to present black people in a different light. He wants to show them, much like his own life, how he started off not having anything, like most black people. But he continued to work and work and work his way up to where he could even buy farmland, buy his own property. And then he became a filmmaker, and he wanted to disrupt the dominant narrative. And he wanted to present black people in a different light. Not only for white people to see there's a difference, but for black people to see themselves differently, represented differently. So I think he, you know, as I came to learn about him and see how important of a figure he was, I think he's someone that people have to study, to read, to research, do some research on. And then you come to someone like a Spike Lee. Everyone knows Spike Lee, but his film Do the Right Thing, not only was it a film depicting an event that happened prior to the making of the film, so a young man had in Brooklyn had been killed by a chokehold, but it was also, it's relevant for today. We saw what happened with George Floyd. We see the things that are happening today. That film was prophetic. That film could speak to, in the 80s, it could speak to the 90s, it could speak to 2020. So I think it's important to look at Spike Lee's work as a whole to see what is he trying to do. Is he trying to just tell black stories? Is he trying to disrupt the narrative? Is he trying to kind of present history, represent history to us? What is he trying to do? So I think Spike is someone that we shouldn't just look to for entertainment, but understand the depths of his message, his overall message with his films. Hmm.
I wanted to mention before we finish that I really appreciate what you have written that helps me warm up to the term of white supremacy. And to be perfectly honest, it's a term of which I'm not very fond. And I only mean that in the sense that I think it is a term that is very easily misunderstood by the very people who need to understand it the most. And I guess it's partly that I think the term is sometimes misunderstood to basically mean if you're white, you have it made. You know, I mean, if you're white, you are king of the hill. And of course the problem with that is it misses the point that there are all kinds of white people who have all kinds of struggles, including plenty of whites who are, you know, themselves marginalized in some respects. And I think it just seems like the term white supremacy is in some ways kind of a careless way to summarize something just a bit more complicated. That being said, I feel like I appreciate the truth of the term much better after reading your book, and in particular the way in which you use some other terms like white sovereignty, or in many cases talk about kind of white centeredness. That's as much as anything what this is about, is people walking around with this idea that white is normal. And then these other people, they might not be terrible people, or we might not even actually think of them as overtly inferior, but those are other people. But we start with the normal people, which are the white people. And whiteness is like where it all begins. And then you add on these other things and these other colors and so on. And as I read that, as you described that, it's like, yes, that is where so many of us, even those of us who hope we're not racist, but walk around with those kind of careless assumptions all the time. In our closing minutes, how would you have us kind of grapple with this idea, which is so hard to talk about? and so hard to, in a sense, take in?
Thank you so much for that question and your response to reading that section of the book. I think it's so important to understand terms, and because over time they get used very differently and can take on different meanings. So when we talk about white supremacy, we talk about this undergirding ideology, this way of seeing white selves in contrast to people of color, particularly in contrast to black people. And it doesn't require malice or intent. Like I said, you can be conditioned to believe something that's normal, and over generations, it just becomes normal, the way you take up space. And I usually compare that to male supremacy and male privilege. I have privilege in spaces. I can go in certain spaces, and I will get opportunities that women won't get. That's just the reality. So when women call that out, I don't take it personally. They're talking about, here's the history, here's the reality. So with white supremacy, it centers whiteness. It makes white the normative, as you talked about. It prizes whiteness. It has established that. I mean, you can look in film, and what's the standard of beauty? Most people are not going to say it's a black woman, a Latino, a Latina, indigenous. They're going to say blonde hair, maybe slim white woman, blue eyes, fair skin. Historically, that has been the standard of beauty. Well, when I use white sovereignty, I'm adding the layer of, well, who decided that was the standard of beauty? So white supremacy is the quality of whiteness being superior to everything, everyone else. But white sovereignty says that whiteness has assumed the authority to decide who is normal, who is more human, more beautiful, more civil, more intelligent. So I think we have to add that term into it as well. But I think if people actually paused and understood what white supremacy, what whiteness as a worldview, white supremacy as an ideology really is, and also how it affects white people. When that word was invented and codified in the 17th century for the purposes of creating this, of solidifying this hierarchy and dividing poor whites and blacks at the time, when that word was created, it also stripped white people of their ancestry. So you became white when at once you were British or Irish or Dutch or what have you. Now white becomes the identifier. Well, that strips you of something as well. And poor white people have never benefited from white supremacy other than the fact that they're viewed through that membership as not being equal to blacks on the social hierarchy, the African Americans. That's the only benefit. Hmm. But they too have been exploited, not to the degree as African Americans or indigenous people, but they don't benefit from white supremacy other than that. And so taking a pause and actually understanding what the term means, and it's not just saying every white person is racist. You can do racist things and not be a racist person at your core. Just like I can do a sexist, something that's sexist, or make a sexist remark, but in no way, shape, or form am I sexist. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that pause and really understanding what this term means and how it has conditioned me as a white person. Because as a black person, I have to look at how it has conditioned me as well, mm-hmm. through media, through film, through education, and so on.
Mm. Your book is exactly that opportunity, I think, to stop and pause and carefully consider so much of what we kind of carelessly toss around. It gave me so much to think about. The book, again, is The Prophetic Lens, The Camera, and Black Moral Agency from Martin Luther King to Darnella Frazier, published by Fortress Press, and the author, Phil Allen, Jr. Thank you, Mr. Allen, for this conversation and for this remarkable book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And we're approaching 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast, partly sunny today, a high near 81 degrees overnight, low of 66, sunny again tomorrow with a high of 82 degrees, with a 60% chance of showers developing tomorrow night and into Sunday. Sunday's high, once again, 81 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.